Good morning, I'm Jim Packard, sitting in for this hour of Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Glad to have you along with us today. Can you recall John Billington, Anne Bonny, or Stephen Pleasanton's place in history? We're going to be talking about them and others from a book by Michael Farquhar called A Treasury of Foolishly Forgotten Americans, Pirates, Skinflints, Patriots, and Other Colorful Characters Stuck in the Footnotes of History. Michael is the author of A Treasury of Royal Scandals, A Treasury of Great American Scandals, and A Treasury of Deception. He's a former writer and editor of the Washington Post, specializing in history. He's co-author of The Century, History as It Happened, on the front page of the Capitol's newspaper. His work has been featured in a number of publications, and he has appeared as a commentator on such programs as the History's Channel, Russia, Land of the Tsars, and the French Revolution. And it's a pleasure to have Michael Farquhar on the telephone with us this morning. Good morning, Michael.
Good morning, Jim. How you doing?
I'm fine. Thank you very much. And how about yourself?
Very well, thank you.
Excellent. I really enjoyed reading this collection of neglected notables, starting with Mr. John Billington, who I'd not heard of before.
Yeah, it's, you know, we're so used to our pristine Thanksgiving story, and I thought this was just an interesting tale of somebody who really upset the colony. He was a real troublemaker, an ornery fellow, and he ended up killing one of his fellow settlers. And his became the first trial and execution in the new colony.
He and his family were among the passengers on the Mayflower as it came to the United States, correct?
Right, and they were a truly troublesome lot. One of his sons almost blew up the Mayflower by lighting a match too close to the gunpowder stash. They were nothing but trouble. And as I said, it culminated in a murder right in the new colony.
The victim, whose name was Newcomen, John Newcomen, was able to identify him before he passed on, and so Mr. Billington then got his comeuppance.
Exactly, and I mentioned in the book that it was definitely cause for a second Thanksgiving among the pilgrims to finally get rid of this guy who had just caused them no end of trouble.
Well, this is a collection of 30-some men and women as we're talking about the Mayflower, we're obviously talking about early American history here, and then going on and up through, what, the 1940s, 50s?
Up to the 60s.
Okay.
Yeah, each of these people represent a different period of our history, and each has contributed in amazing ways to the American experience, not always for good, in the case of John Billington, but in ways that have helped shape the people and the history of our country. And it's a shame to me that all these people have been overlooked. I was only able to rescue 30 of them, but there's thousands of these neglected notables that contributed in fascinating ways that no one remembers.
Well, how did you happen to come across their stories?
Well, I've been writing about history for years with the Post and with these books that I've been writing. You know, and as I would research something, often a name would come up, and you go, "God, that's an interesting person. I never heard of them." You know, oftentimes in the footnotes or, you know, somewhere just buried in the text. And I started collecting them in a notebook, thinking maybe it would be a great book one day to expand on these people. And so that's how that came about, essentially.
Mm-hmm. Let's talk about Mary Dwyer, your second person that you have highlighted, the Quaker martyr.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting. We kind of think of the pilgrims coming over for religious freedom. But once the Puritans established themselves in Massachusetts, there was no such thing as religious freedom. And a particularly persecuted group were the Quakers, because they had the audacity to believe that the Holy Spirit would direct them, not the Puritan hierarchy.
Mm-hmm.
And so they were tortured. They were treated like witches, tortured, banished. And Mary Dwyer was determined to defy these laws against Quakers in Massachusetts. And she was banished from the colony, and she came back, banished again, came back, and ultimately gave her life on Boston Common for the Quaker cause to defy these nasty laws against Quakers. A real hero, a pillar of religious tolerance, that's completely forgotten.
Mm-hmm. Well, she sure had backbone because she refused to bend to the authority.
Yeah, I mean, it would have been a lot easier for her just to stay the heck out of Massachusetts. But this was something that she, you know, felt driven to do. And she paid for it with her life.
And that was on apparently like June 1st, 1660, if my math is correct here.
I believe you're right.
If you'd like to join the conversation about this treasury of foolishly forgotten Americans, pirates, skinflints, patriots, and other colorful characters stuck in the footnotes of history, you can call us in Madison at 263-1890. Otherwise, it's toll-free at 800-642-1234. It seems to me that there are not going to be many people who are going to recognize the personalities that you're outlining.
I hope not, Jim, or it would give lie to the whole premise of the book. These are people that I didn't recognize, or I had heard, you know, little things about. One example is Mary Surratt, who was the first woman executed by the United States government as a conspirator in the Lincoln assassination. You know, I had heard a little bit about her, being from Washington and having a lot of the events happen right here. But when I started researching her story, it became just so interesting to me that it's still not established, her guilt or her innocence in this assassination.
Well, what was she accused of?
She was accused of hatching the plot with Booth to kill Lincoln. And it's interesting because Booth would meet at her boarding house, which was right across from Ford's Theater. And but there are people that say she was just a gracious hostess who was entertaining a major celebrity at the time. And others said, no, she was absolutely conspiring against the president. One of the conspirators that was hanged with her says she was completely innocent. Another one of them says, no, she was actively involved. And historians are still trying to find that one shred of evidence that would indicate once and for all her guilt or her innocence. The trial certainly didn't establish anything. It was a rush to judgment, a military tribunal. She was very poorly represented, and maybe a more fair trial would have established better her exact involvement. But as it stands now, it remains one of those great historical mysteries. So her story was fascinating to me, and it's just one of 30 in here.
Mm-hmm. So she's Mary Surratt, the mother of conspirators, because at this point we really don't have definitive evidence to prove one way or the other?
Right. It doesn't look good for her, I will say that. Meeting with these conspirators in her boarding house and arranging for certain materials to be at her other home outside of Washington, where Booth picked up binoculars and rifles after killing Lincoln. You know, there were other people involved in the conspiracy who were not punished like she was. And it just makes for a very interesting tale, I think.
Mm-hmm. Now, some people think that she was charmed by Booth, the great actor, genuine superstar in his day. And is that possible?
It is possible. I mean, he really was an idol at the time. And it was her son, John Surratt, who had been plotting with Booth to kidnap Lincoln before the assassination took place. And whether Mary Surratt was involved in that is questionable. And if she was, does that make her complicit in the eventual assassination? And again, these questions just remain unanswered.
We're talking with Michael Farquhar about his treasury of foolishly forgotten Americans, pirates, skinflints, patriots, and other colorful characters stuck in the footnotes of history. And the telephone number for you to join in Madison is 263-1890 or toll free at 800-642-1234. Let's take some calls. We'll start with Lou in Waukesha. Hi, Lou. What's on your mind?
I'm thinking of this as a golden resource for some documentary-type movies. In other words, you have a lot of movies lately based on total lies. Why not take something like this and push it to make some productions like that based on fact?
Well, Lou, it's interesting. There is one story in here. It's a story about Guy Gobaldon, who was an 18-year-old Marine private during World War II in the Battle of Saipan. And what he would do, he would sneak out on these lone missions and go to the caves where the Japanese enemy were hiding out and convince them that he had an American force behind him and, you know, urge them to surrender or they'd be roasted alive inside their caves. And these adventures that he went all by himself culminated in the surrender of 800 Japanese at the end of the Battle of Saipan. And they did make a movie about him. Unfortunately, the movie flopped, and nobody remembers this guy. And he's a true American hero, and I think it's a great idea. I think that some of these people are, the stories are so compelling that they would make great films.
I think so.
Lou?
Yes, I think so.
Okay.
Right.
Well, good idea. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Lou.
Have any of your other books been, or stories that you've uncovered have been made into film one way or the other?
No. No. My other books have dealt with more mainstream history in the fact that the people aren't obscure. I mean, I wrote about royal scandals, European royal scandals from the Roman Empire up to the 20th century, and, you know, a lot of them have been covered, and same with some of the American stories I've written. But these obscure Americans, I believe the only one is this man I mentioned, Guy Gobaldon.
Well, if anyone was going to have their story told, it could be Anne Bonny.
Oh, she's great. I mean, there's nothing like a female pirate to pique my interest.
Yeah.
And when I came across her, I was just enthralled. She was, at the turn of the 18th century, this wild girl from South Carolina who grew up in an aristocratic family, but just was unbalanced from the beginning. And she hooks up with this pirate, Calico Jack Rackham, who saw that certain savage something in her and invited her aboard his pirate ship. And together they just terrorized the West Indies. And it's her story is just so fascinating. It was very rare to have a female pirate. And what I liked about her is she showed up at Calico Jack's execution, and she snarls at him, "If you'd fought like a man, you wouldn't be hung like a dog," which I thought was a real touching farewell worthy of a female pirate.
Well, it's kind of funny because you think, there's very rare stories about female pirates, and yet she was not the only female pirate aboard Calico Jack's ship.
Exactly. She and Calico Jack plundered this other ship, and on board that one was a woman dressed as a man. And her name was Mary Read, and they invited her aboard. And so there ended up to be two female pirates on Calico Jack's ship, which, you know, is unprecedented in history. And it's just a great story of their swashbuckling, terrorizing adventures.
You write about a woman named Dorothy Thomas who was attacked while alone in a canoe on the north side of Jamaica, and in her deposition, she later stated that the two women wore men's jackets, long trousers, handkerchiefs tied about their heads. Each of them had a machete and a pistol in their hands and cursed and swore at the men and that they should kill her or prevent her coming against them, and that woman, Dorothy Thomas, felt that she then believed them to be women, and that, I suppose, was quite unlikely at that moment.
Yeah, she had undergone an ordeal that could only be imagined, and her deposition was very vivid in her description of these two women, these two terrorists.
And they were hung?
No, they were condemned to be hung, and both claimed to be pregnant, and it was found that they were indeed pregnant, and they were spared the noose. And what became of both of them remains a mystery. Mary Read is believed to have died during childbirth, and Anne Bonny disappeared. And there's no record of what happened to her.
I like your last line. She fought like a man, and unlike Calico Jack, she wasn't hanged like a dog. We'll take more of your calls in just a moment as we talk with Michael Farquhar, the author of A Treasury of Foolishly Forgotten Americans, Pirates, Skinflints, Patriots, and Other Colorful Characters Stuck in the Footnotes of History. It's published by Penguin and is just a month or so old. I'm Jim Packard, and you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Jim Packard sitting in for Kathleen Dunn for this hour on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Glad to have you along with us today as we talk about Treasury of Foolishly Forgotten Americans with Michael Farquhar. And if you'd like to join in, we have two lines open at the moment in Madison at 263-1890, otherwise toll-free at 800-642-1234. And let's go to Bob in Darlington next. Bob, what's on your mind?
Hey, good morning.
Hi, Bob.
Hi. I've got kind of a neat story. My second cousin from Santa Barbara, California, he created a wonderful genealogy book of my family, Aylesworth. And Oliver Aylesworth was the third Chief Justice of our Supreme Court. You have number one was John Jay, and then Samuel Rutledge, and then Oliver Aylesworth. And Oliver died in the year 1800 of the fluxes and the gout. And I don't know what that really means, but I imagine he had some terrible internal tumor or something like that. And then, of course, gout you're probably well aware of.
Mm-hmm.
But anyway, he was kind of a, he's forgotten in the footnote of time like you're expressing. And he
does he have a terrible tale to tell, though?
No. Well, this is a wonderful ending to this. President Jefferson had a chance then to appoint a new Chief Justice who became probably, I think, one of the best Supreme Court justices the nation has ever known, in John Marshall. You've heard of him?
Yes, certainly.
He was number four. Most people, if they attended grade school, they were told about John Marshall. And the reason he was so famous is that he actually organized the order of the breakdown of the separation of powers between the three branches of government. He was instrumental in setting that up. He developed a wonderful relationship with most of the working politicians during that time, and the first three didn't do much, and it was a very sort of obscure court. But when John Marshall got there, he really put the court in its proper place, and he also was instrumental in setting up quite a few precedent-setting law cases that are still quite unique to this day.
Yeah.
One of them being the case between Marbury and Madison.
Okay.
Well, you know, Bob, it's interesting when you say that the first three didn't do much. I have found that when you start researching somebody's life, it often comes out that there is something really fascinating about this person, and that's what kind of got me excited about uncovering all these people. You think, for example, there were four FBI directors before Hoover, but yet the entire history of the FBI is kind of associated with him. And one of them, who I write about in this book, William J. Burns, was the greatest detective of his day. He solved, fascinating cases, including the 1910 terrorist bombing of the L.A. Times building. And yet he's completely lost in the mist of time, and nobody would even think that there was a director before Hoover. So I bet you, I didn't research any of these Supreme Court justices that the first three, but I can guarantee you, with a little work, there would be an interesting story with any one of them.
Well, Bob, they're famous, but they're not famous for what we're looking for today, and that's the foolishly forgotten American pirates, skinflints, patriots, other colorful characters stuck in the footnotes of history. But we do appreciate hearing from you. Let's see what Barbara has on her mind.
Well, good morning, Jim, and good morning to your guests.
Good
and my
morning,
husband
Barbara.
And I were just having a chuckle about this gentleman because we thought that, gee, we've got our own fellow right here who used to live in McFarland, and I'm talking about Edward Ben Elson. And, Jim, I'm sure you remember him selling tickets on Cohotec.
Eddie was a personal friend of mine, yes.
Well, he was was a personal friend of yours. Well, lovely. And, of course, you know, he really was a colorful fellow, and he did sell some tickets on Cohotec, didn't he, Jim?
He did indeed.
And do you remember him declaring for his district attorney in his toga?
Yes.
And saying he was only going to obey, enforce good laws?
That was his philosophy that he lived by, only obey good laws.
Don't you think he deserves some recognition? He was such a colorful gentleman.
He was indeed. And I'm sure that Michael Farquhar would have enjoyed knowing him as well, and not only enjoying his story, but enjoying him as a person as well. He was a very bright lawyer.
He was.
He went to the Ohio State University, where he used to tutor the football team members. But then his life here in Madison, in the Madison area, was as a very colorful, eccentric sort of lawyer who took on interesting cases, and his life ended way too suddenly.
Yes, it did. Thank you, Jim.
I do appreciate your call, Barbara. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
And Chris in Barneveld, let's go to you. Hi.
Yeah, hi. I wanted to ask about Father Divine, or I think his name was George Baker, who in the early 1900s sort of developed a large, inspirational church in New York. Are you familiar with this figure?
I'm not. I write about one evangelist, Zilpha Elaw, who was African American and yet preaching in the South. And there was these amazing religious movements in our history, the First Great Awakening, the Second Great Awakening, where there was just a true religious fervor that in itself is largely forgotten. And I thought she was just interesting because of the fact that she was a woman, and because she was black, and would risk going down to the South to preach because that's what she felt she had been directed to do. It and could have been captured and enslaved at any moment. But that's a part of our history that a lot of people forget, are these religious movements. But I'm not familiar with who you're speaking about.
She had an interesting name, Zilpha. Elaw, Elaw, very unlikely. And her call from God came to her as she was, milking a cow?
Exactly. Some of these new religions were expanding. They needed women as preachers. But once they established themselves, the women were kind of overlooked and certainly erased from the history of these various sects and religions, which I just find so fascinating. So she's the one representative evangelist in this book.
Mm-hmm. And she went to England, and that's apparently where the story ends.
Right. But her being black and preaching in the South and the adventures that she had down there make her story extremely compelling.
Chris, thank you very much. I'm sorry we don't have more on George Baker, Father Divine. If you'd like to join the conversation and ask about a footnote person in history, then in Madison, the number is 263-1890. Otherwise, toll free at 800-642-1234. And, of course, our email address is still talk@wpr.org. We're talking with Michael Farquhar, who is a former editor and reporter, a writer at the Washington Post, specializing in history. He's the author of A Treasury of Royal Scandals, A Treasury of Great American Scandals, A Treasury of Deception, and his latest book is A Treasury of Foolishly Forgotten Americans. You must have a whole bunch of stories saved up ready for your next book.
Yeah, that's the frustrating thing with this one was that I had to limit it to 30. And, you know, these callers with these names that are coming in, just indicate how many people are out there in our history that need to be rescued. And I'd love to do another volume of these. I mean, you could do 20 and still not begin to cover, all of the fascinating people that have contributed to the American experience in good ways and in bad.
You say that America's first superstar was a man by the name of Edwin Forrest. the latter-day American Idol.
Yeah, he was the preeminent American actor. He was adored. This is in this era before cinema, when it was stage actors that were revered. And this was also a time where it was believed that British actors dominated the stage, that they were far superior to the Americans. And here comes this Edwin Forrest, who gives these great muscular performances of Hamlet and Macbeth, and he became adored. But he was also acting at a time when this ugly nativist trend that was developing in the United States, and he was in competition with this British actor, George Begretti. And what resulted from their competition was this horrible riot, the Astor Place riot up in New York, left scores killed. And this is all over the various merits of an American actor versus a British actor. Really, really great story.
Yeah, it is a great story as it reads. And McCready probably was not ready for the response from the audience that he received that night.
Oh, absolutely not. He had gotten a little bit of a preview of what was going to happen when eggs and various unsavory articles were thrown up on stage at him. But no, the night of that riot, he would have had no idea what was happening. I mean, it was a brutal, deadly riot.
And that, of course, is one of the stories of the 30 or so stories contained within the Treasury of Foolishly Forgotten Americans. We have Vicki on the line, who maybe has something to add about Father Divine. Hi, Vicki.
Good morning.
Good morning.
I wanted to tell you that in the early 1950s, I had gotten out of college and had gone to Philadelphia to work in one of the Quaker projects. I wasn't a Quaker, but I had a dean that was. And one of the things that we did in Philadelphia, we lived in the then so-called black section. I think it was 10th and Wallace. We were hosted by a black church there that happened to have a dormitory adjacent. And it was a wonderful summer. We were thoroughly accepted by the community. And one of our events was to go to Father Divine's. So this was Philadelphia. In the evening, and they had midnight meals. I'm not quite sure why. So we went a little early, and we heard choruses sing. There were two groups of ladies that wore college blazers. One group had red blazers, and the other separate group had green blazers, and it turned out that one group were called the Virgins, and the other group were called Virgins by Choice.
Mm-hmm.
So we had the musical ensemble, and then when we were very well accepted. We were a mixed group of college kids. When we sat at the table after midnight, all I remember about the food, it was very wholesome food, was that when each dish was passed, and these were free meals available to the community,
mm-hmm.
and before each dish reached you, you were told that it was salt or saltless. And I don't know why that sticks in my memory, but we had I had not ever been aware of community, free meals for communities, and most of us had not come from backgrounds where food was an issue. But in Philadelphia, even in the early 50s, this was an important contribution to that community, and it was indeed Father Divine, who at that time had a young Canadian wife. He happened to be black, she happened to be white, and it was, for all of us, quite a learning experience.
Boy, it sounds that way. You're taking all this down, I assume, Michael.
I'm taking copious notes.
And I do want a little bit of remuneration for that, if it sells, or if it's cast into a movie.
Oh, Vicki, thank you very much.
Thanks, Vicki.
I think you've got him on the scent now, as it were. Mike in Appleton, let's give you a chance. Hi, go ahead.
Yes, good morning. Anything about William Donovan, Wild Bill Donovan? He was the originator of the OSS, today CIA. He also won the Congressional Medal of Honor. He was a lawyer, made a lot of money. He was quite a guy.
He was too well known to be included in this book, I think.
Yes, but he is actually mentioned in the book, believe it or not, in association with Elizabeth Bentley, who I write about, the Red Spy Queen,
mm-hmm.
Who actually controlled Soviet spies here in the United States, and one of them was the personal secretary to William Donovan, which is an interesting thing to think about is, you know, we kind of label the McCarthy era as a terrible witch hunt against communists, but there indeed they did exist. McCarthy obviously exaggerated in many ways, but that's what's become sort of gospel in our history, is that this was all a myth, that these subversives were actually working within the government, and the fact of the matter was that they were. And this is an interesting story I tell about Elizabeth Bentley, that she was controlling many of them, and William Donovan's personal secretary was one of them.
And you indicate that there were more than 70 special agents working on this espionage case in the FBI's history.
Yeah, I mean, it was Elizabeth Bentley is essentially responsible for launching this second Red Scare in America, and a lot, she was kind of dismissed as a kook at the time, except by Hoover and the FBI. But these Venona records, these transcripts between the Soviet government and the handlers here in the United States, verify a lot of what she had to say about what was going on. I mean, there was people high up in the Roosevelt administration, and the second highest guy up in the Treasury were all Soviet agents, and not necessarily to destroy America, because we were working with the Soviet Union during World War II, and there was some real idealism, misguided idealism, that that this Soviet system would be the way to go, the way of the future. So it's a rather long chapter about Elizabeth Bentley, but a very fascinating figure that's overlooked in our history.
Mike, thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
Appreciate
thanks,
hearing
Mike.
From you about William Donovan, Wild Bill, as he was known, who started OSS, which then turned into the CIA. Serena in Fenimore, let's give you a chance to get into the conversation. Hello.
Hi. A couple of people that have been, I think, forgotten about was a couple of judges from England by the name of Whaley and Gulf. They were in New Haven, Connecticut, or they escaped to New England. They were in New Haven, Connecticut, and there's even a place called the Judge's Cave where they had hidden out for several weeks, and they had condemned, I want to say they were condemned by the King of England. This is back in the 1600s. The reason I know about some of this was one of my ancestors had made a declaration saying that these people, these two guys, had never been found. They were not in the vicinity. And they had been actually tipped off in order to run and hide someplace else. And I think those are people that have never been able to, that have been forgotten in history.
So they were English, though, correct?
They were English. They were English, but they had escaped also
to America.
To America to escape prosecution.
Right, and anybody in America prior to 1776 was English. So, they might qualify. It's just another example of what I was saying earlier, how many interesting stories there are of people in our history that just no one knows about.
Serena, thanks very much for the call. We're talking today with Michael Farquhar, the author of A Treasury of Foolishly Forgotten Americans, and we'll take more of your calls in just a moment here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Jim Packard in for Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network. Glad to have you along with us today as we talk about footnote people. A Treasury of Foolishly Forgotten Americans is written by Michael Farquhar of Washington, D.C. An email, Michael, is from another Mike, and he said the charismatic New York black radio preacher, Father Divine, in the 1920s was the subject of a biography which I believe was entitled God and then - Harlem. A letter bearing that address was delivered by the U.S. Postal Service to Father Divine. So there's another footnote about that person.
Yeah, Father Divine seems to be the common theme.
It is in this program for sure.
That's interesting, and I had never heard of him, but that's because I had doesn't mean anything. I mean, that's what makes these people so fascinating is that you mentioned that somebody had written a biography of Father Divine. What I found interesting as I was researching a lot of these people is even the most obscure Americans have some historian or biographer that's interested in them.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, it wasn't very difficult, particularly being here in Washington with the Library of Congress, to, dig up a lot of this material once I got, a story behind it.
Have you heard of Jesse James Strang, the Mormon king of Beaver Island, who started his Mormon career in Wisconsin in the mid-19th century?
No.
Well, that's Bill in Washington Island. So Jesse James Strang, the Mormon king of Beaver Island, is another person for you to research for your subsequent book.
I think it's going to be a treasury of foolishly forgotten people of Wisconsin.
Let's go to Karen in Platteville next. Hi, Karen.
Hi. Have you ever heard of Hans Herbert Haupt? He came to the United States when he was 10 with his parents. He got what turned out to be my brother's future wife pregnant, got scared, ran off to Mexico, ended up on a freighter to Japan, and ended up in Germany trying to get back to the U.S. when the war broke out. So they trained him as a spy, and he was one of four who landed in Florida, and then they buried everything. And then he came to Chicago, and because he had gotten a draft notice, went to the draft office and got arrested. And then 6 weeks later, he was put to death as a spy, even though he did not commit, only planned to commit an act of sabotage against the war effort in World War II.
Hmm.
And then the other part of the story is that my brother's wife, she was not his wife at the time, had gotten pregnant and had the son adopted out. And we didn't find this out till after she died in the late 90s. And so we're still trying to find him. He was born in December of 41 in Chicago.
Hmm.
Wow.
For private adoption. Now, there's a story.
That's a story. What's the last name?
His last name or mine?
His.
His.
Hans Herbert Haupt.
H-U-A-P-T?
Uh-huh. And my brother's wife had to testify before Congress. Biddle was the interrogator. It's all on public record on the Internet.
Wow. What is that? I mean, that sounds really interesting.
Oh, it is. I'm still trying to find, though, the child of this, relationship.
Right.
See you there again, Jim.
It's going to be all Wisconsin all the time, it looks like.
This person was from Chicago.
I understand. We'll find a link to Wisconsin somehow.
Well, that's me.
Yes. Karen, thank you very much.
That just sounds inherently interesting. I appreciate you saying something about it. This whole conversation is just making me believe more and more that there needs to be another volume.
It sounds like it, doesn't it?
It really does.
If someone wants to find out more about you and your books, your last name is, as I have it, is F-A-R-Q-U-H-A-R.
Correct.
Farquhar. All right. Michael Farquhar, his book is A Treasury of Foolishly Forgotten Americans. And if you'd like to join the conversation, the number for you in Madison is 263-1890. Otherwise, it's toll-free at 800-642-1234. We've talked about a few of the characters that you have enhanced in this book. William Dawes is someone that people may not know about or recall.
Yeah, he's a really interesting guy. William Dawes rode on the same night as Paul Revere did. Both guys faced equal peril and adventure trying to get to Lexington and warn Sam Adams and John Hancock. But Revere gets all the credit thanks to Longfellow, who made him an icon of American history. And Dawes, I say, was at the right place with the wrong rhyme.
Mm-hmm.
He's just been overlooked, and yet again, it was Dawes and Revere who were going out that night. They took separate paths so that if one of them got captured, the other one would get the message to Lexington. But yet, all we think about that night is Paul Revere and the steeple lights and all of that, and yet this other hero, William Dawes, lies all but forgotten, except for a few of his descendants in Boston.
And the injustice of it all was captured in a poem written by Helen F. Moore and published in 1896 in Century Magazine. and that who rode as boldly and as well God walked, what should I ask? The reason is clear. My name was Dawes and his Revere. When the lights from the Old North Church flashed out, Paul Revere was waiting about, but I was already on my way. The shadows of night fell cold and gray as I rode, with never a break or a pause. But what was the use when my name was Dawes? That's just part of the poem, and you'll find the rest of it in the book A Treasury of Foolishly Forgotten Americans. Let's go back to the phones, take some more calls, find out about some people that we may not have heard of before. Tom in Madison is next. Hi, Tom.
Hi. Well, I just want to first point out that that last woman's case about the soldier that was arrested for sabotage. That's the one the Bush administration cites for all its anti-terrorism legislation. But I wanted to talk about a family friend, Father Coughlin from Detroit, the radio preacher, anti-Semitic, fascist guy. That he's the one who first discovered the mass media. Using radio as mass media, and had people following all over the country, and people drive up miles and miles around. My aunt ended up being his personal secretary after he was muzzled and became a parish priest. He also befriended my dad. My grandfather's a banker. Anyway, he's quite famous, though.
Yeah, he was. I am familiar with him, and his was a really interesting career. But I think you're right. I think he was too famous. A lot of people remember Father Coughlin and he was kind of the Rush Limbaugh of his day in using the mass media. Another interesting guy, but I thought he was too famous to be included.
You have one of the vice presidents listed in the book, Richard Mentor Johnson, the Veep who killed Tecumseh.
Yeah, I mean, you can't get much more obscure than Martin Van Buren's vice president. But yet, there was this, he had this fascinating life, and it was, as you just said, he was actually the one who killed Tecumseh. But when you're the vice president of a very obscure president, your place in history is not secured, despite the great adventures of his life, and some of the interesting facets of his vice presidency, he remains completely overlooked. But, it's a great story about him killing Tecumseh.
I like the slogan that his followers would chant during his campaign for the vice presidency and other posts, Rumpsy Dumpsy, Colonel Johnson killed Tecumseh.
Yeah, it was, and it became, for every campaign that he was ever involved in, that was his claim to fame. And unfortunately, it didn't propel his political future any higher than the vice presidency, and he languishes in obscurity.
Well, you've got stories about John Ledyard is an interesting character, explorer who dreamed of walking the world.
He dreamed of walking the world, exactly, and he actually got to it and made incredible strides in getting across Europe. Unfortunately, he was intercepted in Russia by Catherine the Great's agents and sent back on his way. But he was, he just embodies that spirit of adventure, of the American spirit. And it was his attempt to walk the world that was sponsored by Jefferson and actually inspired the Lewis and Clark expeditions later on. But it's this—it's a great tale of spirit and adventure and of hardiness, the real foundation of America. And his story is, again, one of those just completely forgotten stories. And yet you can see he's an example of somebody who's connected to the events that we are familiar with. For every Lewis and Clark expedition or for every great epic in American history, there are all these people and forces that contributed to them. And that's what I've tried to highlight in this book is, how there are other people involved in the things that we've become most familiar with.
Mm-hmm. So he's another of the 30 or so characters outlined in the book. Leroy in Lone Rock's got some more about Father Divine. Hi, Leroy.
Hi, how are you this morning?
Good. Good.
Hi, Leroy.
Yes. I've enjoyed your program and just happened to here to listen to it this morning, and when you mentioned Father Divine, struck me right away, because right after World War II, a cousin and I went on a motorcycle trip out in New York and Boston and Philadelphia, in that area, Atlantic City. But in those days, before the civil rights movement started, we couldn't get motels or hotels, anything, you know, mm-hmm. unless we run into some town or city that had a black motel. Well, Father Divine had a big motel complex right downtown in Philadelphia, and we come in there about midnight, and someone sent us over there, and we he said, you can get a room there, you know, a lot of like the YMCA is now. And for 50 cents a night, we parked our motorcycles right in the basement, and we stayed there for 50 cents a night. We stayed there for two nights. So I'm familiar with his movement. But one thing I never heard him mention lately, because I'm 81 years old, but he was like a preacher. He couldn't stay in Philadelphia. When Monday morning come, he had to get out of the state of Pennsylvania, because I don't know, he had some trouble of some kind. I never got the true story. I heard the true story, but it's been 60-some years, I forgot.
Yeah.
But anyhow, he had to go back to New York, see. But in that same era, and that movement was like, it reminds me of Barack Obama, because he worked in the community. Now, the big Powell, Clayton Powell Jr., was the big guy for the high-class blacks up in New York in that area. But guys like Divine and a preacher by the name of Clarence Cobb in Chicago, he's another one in that area. They went and they worked the economic ladder, said buy our own places and do our own thing. And out of Detroit, I believe that was another one. But it was for me, it was folk like me and young soldiers come back from War II that suffered the embarrassment, the discrimination in the military. And that was the Dad of Grace, I believe, in New York. I mean, Detroit, rather. So those three guys, were history makers before King and the big civil rights movement got on. So this is interesting that I like to hear stuff like the gentleman is talking about. So I thought I'd just add that in.
Well, thank you so much, Leroy.
Okay.
Yeah, I appreciate it. This Father Divine sounds really compelling. Of course, I don't think, you know, after so many people have now discussed him, I don't think he'll qualify as obscure anymore.
Well, outside of Wisconsin, he's still obscure.
All right. Well, we'll see what we can do about getting him some more prominence.
And one of our callers couldn't stay with us, but had a comment about Father Coughlin, that he was hated because he was considered a Nazi. And that person remembers because he's now in his 80s, and that stuck with him back from World War II era days.
Yeah, Father Coughlin was certainly controversial.
All of the people in this book, save for one, have passed on. We think that Dick Fosbury, the father of the Fosbury Flop, is still with us. As far as you know, is that true?
Yeah, he's still with us. He lives in Ketchum, Idaho.
And the reason that the reason that Dick Fosbury,
he was such an interesting guy. You take this third-rate athlete who really wasn't amounting to much in the sport of high jumping. And yet what he did was transform that sport utterly with the Fosbury Flop. It's the standard now by which high jumpers jump.
Mm-hmm.
And I just thought, you know, not that the high jumping is that prominent of a sport or that it matters that much, but yet it does. When you just think of this literally a third-rate athlete transforming something and winning the gold at the 68 Mexico Olympics. And it's just an example of somebody in a small way that made a big difference.
And he is still alive in Ketchum, Idaho.
He's still with us.
And
and as a matter of fact, there was a question mark as to whether I should include him or not, because, you know, as you mentioned, all the other 29 are dead. And history is the ultimate arbiter of historical status. And who knows? Maybe one day high jumping will be something that everybody's riveted by, and that he'll no longer be obscure, that he'll be the hero of high jumping.
Well, as the Olympic Games go on this summer, why people should watch the high jump and watch the technique, because prior to Dick Fosbury, everyone jumped a different way, and he totally transformed the sport.
And he was, you know, roundly criticized for it. I mean, people thought it was dangerous, you know, going over backwards, and that he was ruining the sport, and yet it is now the standard. And It's just his life is interesting, and his contribution is interesting.
Here are a couple of near-miss politicians sent in by another Mike. Garrett Hobart, President McKinley's first-term vice president, died in office. If he had lived to serve in McKinley's second term, he would have become U.S. president when McKinley was assassinated. And Hannibal Hamlin, Abraham Lincoln's first-term vice president, didn't get nominated for a second term. Don't know why. If he'd been renominated, he would have become president when Lincoln was shot. So Garrett Hobart and Hannibal Hamlin, are you familiar with those?
Yeah, I would be, and it's interesting. I think we did pretty well with Teddy Roosevelt instead, but I can't imagine you could get worse than Andrew Johnson. And Hamlin might have been a better president. Well, you know, we never know.
Well, it's been a pleasure to talk with you today. I really appreciate you taking the time to talk with us about this treasury of foolishly forgotten Americans.
Thank you, Jim. This has been great, and
thanks.
I appreciate all the calls.
Thanks, Michael, and we'll look for your next book.
Thank you.
All Wisconsin, all the time. Thanks, Michael. And thanks also to Rhonda Fanning for producing the show and Carmen Jackson for on-air production. I'm Jim Packard, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.